Chapter 3 The Lone Islands.
"Land in sight!" shouted the man in the bows.
Lucy, who had been talking to Rince on the poop, came pattering down the ladder and raced forward. As she went, she was joined by Edmund, and they found Caspian, Drinian, and Reepicheep already on the forecastle. It was a coldish morning, the sky very pale, and the sea very dark blue with little white caps of foam, and there, a little way off on the starboard bow, was the nearest of the lone islands, Felimath, like a low green hill in the sea, and behind it, further off, the grey slopes of its sister, Dourne.
"Same old Felimath! Same old Dourne!" said Lucy, clapping her hands. "Oh, Edmund, how long is it since you and I saw them last?"
"I've never understood why they belong to Narnia," said Caspian. "Did Peter the High King conquer them?"
"Oh, no," said Edmund. "They were Narnian before our time, in the days of the White Witch."
"By the way, I have never yet heard how these remote islands became attached to the crown of Narnia. If I ever do, and if the story is at all interesting, I may put it in some other book."
"Are we to put in here, sire?" asked Drinian.
"I shouldn't think it would be much good landing on Felimath," said Edmund. "It was almost uninhabited in our days, and it looks as if it is the same still. The people live mostly on Dourne, and a little on Avra, that's the third one. You can't see it yet. They only keep sheep on Felimath."
"Then we'll have to double that cape, I suppose," said Drinian, "and land on Dourne. That'll mean rowing."
"I'm sorry we're not landing on Felimath," said Lucy. "I'd like to walk there again. It was so lonely, a nice kind of loneliness, and all grass and clover and soft sea air."
"I'd love to stretch my legs, too," said Caspian. "I tell you what, why shouldn't we go ashore in the boat and send it back, and then we could walk across Felimath and let the Dawn Treader pick us up on the other side?"
If Caspian had been as experienced then as he became later on in this voyage, he would not have made this suggestion. But at the moment it seemed an excellent one.
"Oh, do let's," said Lucy.
"You'll come, will you?"
said Caspian to Eustace, who had come on deck with his hand bandaged.
"Anything to get off this blasted boat," said Eustace.
"Blasted?" said Drinian. "How do you mean?"
"In a civilized country, like where I come from," said Eustace, "the ships are so big that when you're inside you wouldn't know you were at sea at all."
"In that case, you might just as well stay ashore," said Caspian. "Will you tell them to lower the boat, Drinian?" The king, the mouse, the two Pevenses, and Eustace all got into the boat and were pulled to the beach of Felimath. When the boat had left them and was being rowed back, they all turned and looked round. They were surprised at how small the Dawn Treader looked. Lucy was, of course, barefoot, having kicked off her shoes while swimming, but that is no hardship if one is going to walk on downy turf. It was delightful to be ashore again, and to smell the earth and grass, even if at first the ground seemed to be pitching up and down like a ship, as it usually does for a while if one has been at sea. It was much warmer here than it had been on board, and Lucy found the sand pleasant to her feet as they crossed it. There was a lark singing. They struck inland and up a fairly steep, though low, hill. At the top, of course, they looked back, and there was the Dawn Treader, shining like a great bright insect, and crawling slowly northwestward with her oars. Then they went over the ridge and could see her no longer. Dourne now lay before them, divided from Felimath by a channel about a mile wide. Behind it and to the left lay Avra. The little white town of Narrow Haven on Dourne was easily seen.
"Hello? What's this?" said Edmund suddenly.
In the green valley to which they were descending, six or seven rough-looking men, all armed, were sitting by a tree.
"Don't tell them who we are," said Caspian.
"And pray, Your Majesty, why not?"
said Weepy Cheep, who had consented to ride on Lucy's shoulder.
"It just occurred to me," replied Caspian, "that no one here can have heard from Narnia for a long time. It's just possible they may not still acknowledge our overlordship, in which case it might not be quite safe to be known as the king."
"We have our sword, sire," said Weepy Cheep.
"Yes, Reep, I know we have," said Caspian, "but if it is a question of reconquering the three islands, I'd prefer to come back with a rather larger army."
By this time they were quite close to the strangers, one of whom, a big, black-haired fellow, shouted out,
"A good morning to you."
"And a good morning to you," said Caspian. "Is there still a governor of the Lone Islands?"
To be sure there is," said the man. "Governor Gumpus. His sufficiency is at Narrow Haven. But you'll stay and drink with us?"
Caspian thanked him, though neither he nor the others much liked the look of their new acquaintance, and all of them sat down. But hardly had they raised their cups to their lips when the black-haired man nodded to his companions, and, as quick as lightning, all the five visitors found themselves wrapped in strong arms. There was a moment's struggle, but all the advantages were on one side, and soon everyone was disarmed and had their hands tied behind their backs, except Reepy Cheep, writhing in his captor's grip and biting furiously.
"Careful with that beast, Tax," said the leader. "Don't damage him. He'll fetch the best price of the lot, I shouldn't wonder."
"Coward! Poltroon!" squeaked Reepy Cheep. "Give me my sword and free my paws if you dare!"
"Oof!"
whistled the slave merchant, for that is what he was.
"It couldn't talk. Well, I never did. Blowed if I take less than 200 crescents for him."
The Calamen crescent, which is the chief coin in those parts, is worth about a third of a pound.
"So that's what you are," said Caspian. "A kidnapper and slaver. I hope you're proud of it."
Now, said the slaver. "Don't you start any jaw. The easier you take it, the pleasanter all round, see? I don't do this for fun. I've got my living to make, same as everyone else."
"Where will you take us?"
asked Lucy, getting the words out with some difficulty.
"Over to Narrowhaven," said the slaver. "For market day tomorrow."
"Is there a British consul there?" asked Eustace.
"Is there a witch?"
said the man. But long before Eustace was tired of trying to explain, the slaver simply said,
"Well, I've had enough of this jabber. The mouse is a fair treat, but this one will talk the iron leg of a donkey. Off we go, mates."
Then the four human prisoners were roped together, not cruelly, but securely, and made to march down to the shore. Reepy Cheep was carried. He had stopped biting on a threat of having his mouth tied up. But he had a great deal to say, and Lucy really wondered how any man could bear to have the things said to him which were said to the slave dealer by the mouse. But the slave dealer, far from objecting, only said,
"Go on,"
whenever Reepy Cheep paused for breath, occasionally adding,
"It's as good as a play," or, "Blimey, you can't help almost thinking it knows what it's saying," or, "Was it one of you what trained it?"
This so infuriated Reepy Cheep that in the end the number of things he thought of saying all at once nearly suffocated him, and he became silent. When they got down to the shore that looked towards Doon, they found a little village and a longboat on the beach, and lying a little further out, a dirty, bedraggled-looking ship.
"Now, youngsters," said the slave dealer, "let's have no fuss, and then you'll have nothing to cry about. All aboard."
At that moment, a fine-looking bearded man came out of one of the houses, an inn, I think, and said,
"Well, Pug, more of your usual wares?"
The slaver, whose name seemed to be Pug, bowed very low and said in a wheedling kind of voice,
"Yes, if it please your lordship."
"How much do you want for that boy?" asked the other, pointing to Caspian.
"Ah," said Pug, "I knew your lordship would pick on the best. No deceiving your lordship with anything second-rate. That boy now, I've taken a fancy to him myself. Got kind of fond of him, I have. I'm that tender-hearted. I didn't ever ought to have taken up this job. Still, to a customer like your lordship." "Tell me your price, Carrion," said the lord sternly. "Do you think I want to listen to the rigmarole of your filthy trade?" 300 crescents, my lord, to your honourable lordship, but to anyone else, I'll give you 150.
"Oh, please, please," broke in Lucy, "don't separate us, whatever you do. You don't know—"
But then she stopped, for she saw that Caspian didn't even now want to be known.
150, then," said the lord. "As for you, little maiden, I am sorry I cannot buy you all. Unrope, my boy, Pug. And look, treat these others well while they are in your hands, or it'll be the worse for you."
"Well," said Pug, "now whoever heard of a gentleman in my way of business who treated his stock better than what I do? Well, why, I treat them like my own children."
"That's likely enough to be true," said the other grimly. The dreadful moment had now come. Caspian was untied, and his new master said,
"This way, lad."
And Lucy burst into tears, and Edmund looked very blank. But Caspian looked over his shoulder and said, "Cheer up. I'm sure it will come all right in the end. So long."
"Now, missy," said Pug, "don't you start taking on and spoiling your looks for the market tomorrow. You be a good girl, and then you won't have nothing to cry about. See?"
Then they were rowed out to the slave ship, and taken below into a long, rather dark place, none too clean, where they found many other unfortunate prisoners. For Pug was, of course, a pirate, and had just returned from cruising among the islands and capturing what he could. The children didn't meet anyone whom they knew. The prisoners were mostly Galmians and Terebinthians. And there they sat in the straw and wondered what was happening to Caspian, and tried to stop Eustace talking as if everyone except himself was to blame. Meanwhile, Caspian was having a much more interesting time. The man who had bought him led him down a little lane between two of the village houses, and so out into an open place behind the village. Then he turned and faced him.
"You needn't be afraid of me, boy," he said. "I'll treat you well. I bought you for your face. You reminded me of someone."
"May I ask of whom, my lord?" said Caspian.
"You remind me of my master, King Caspian of Narnia."
Then Caspian decided to risk everything on one stroke. "My lord," he said, "I am your master. I am Caspian, King of Narnia."
"You make very free," said the other. "How shall I know this is true?"
"Firstly, by my face," said Caspian. "Secondly, because I know within 6 guesses who you are. You are one of those 7 lords of Narnia whom my uncle Miraz sent to sea, and whom I have come out to look for. Argos, Bairn, Octesian, Restimar, Mavrimorn, or I've forgotten the others. And finally, if your lordship will give me a sword, I will prove on any man's body in clean battle that I am Caspian, the son of Caspian, lawful king of Narnia, lord of Caer Paravel, and emperor of the Lone Islands."
"By heaven," exclaimed the man, "it is his father's very voice and trick of speech. My liege, your majesty."
And there, in the field, he knelt and kissed the king's hand. "The monies your lordship disbursed for our person will be made good from our treasury," said Caspian.
"They are not in Pug's purse yet, sire," said the Lord Byrne, for he it was. "And never will be, I trust.
I have moved His Sufficiency the Governor 100 times to crush this vile traffic in man's flesh.
My Lord Byrne, said Caspian, we must talk of the state of these islands, but first, what is your lordship's own story?
Short enough, sire, said Byrne. I came thus far with my 6 fellows, loved a girl of the islands, and felt I had had enough of the sea. And there was no purpose in returning to Narnia while your Majesty's uncle held the reins, so I married, and have lived here ever since.
And what is this governor, this Gumpas, like? Does he still acknowledge the King of Narnia for his lord?
In words, yes. All is done in the king's name. But he would not be best pleased to find a real live King of Narnia coming in upon him. And if your Majesty came before him alone and unarmed, well, he would not deny his allegiance, but he will pretend to disbelieve you. Your Grace's life would be in danger. What following has your Majesty in these waters?
There is my ship, just rounding the point, said Caspian. We are about 30 swords, if it came to fighting. Shall we not have my ship in, and fall upon Pug, and free my friends whom he holds captive?
Not by my counsel, said Byrne. As soon as there was a fight, 2 or 3 ships would put out from Narrowhaven to rescue Pug. Your Majesty must work by a show of more power than you really have, and by the terror of the king's name. It must not come to plain battle. Gumpus is a chicken-hearted man, and can be overawed.
After a little more conversation, Caspian and Byrne walked down to the coast, a little west of the village, and there Caspian winded his horn. This was not the great magic horn of Narnia, Queen Susan's horn. He had left that at home for his regent Trumpkin to use if any great need fell upon the land in the king's absence. Grinion, who was on the lookout for a signal, recognised the royal horn at once, and the Dawn Treader began standing in to the shore. Then the boat put off again, and in a few moments Caspian and the Lord Byrne were on deck, explaining the situation to Drinian. He, just like Caspian, wanted to lay the Dawn Treader alongside the slave ship at once, and board her, but Byrne made the same objection.
"Steer straight down this channel, Captain," said Byrne, "and then round to Avra, where my own estates are. But first, run up the king's banner, hang out all the shields, and send as many men to the fighting top as you can. And about 5 bowshots hence, when you get open sea on your port bow, run up a few signals."
"Signals? To whom?" said Drinian.
"Why, to all the other ships we haven't got, but which it might be well that Gumpus thinks we have."
"Oh, I see," said Drinian, rubbing his hands. "And they'll read our signals. What shall I say? Whole fleet round the south of Avra, and assemble at—"
"Bernstead," said the Lord Byrne. "That'll do excellently. Their whole journey, if there were any ships, would be out of sight from Narrowhaven." Caspian was sorry for the others, languishing in the hold of Pug's slave ship, but he could not help finding the rest of that day enjoyable. Late in the afternoon, for they had to do all by oar, having turned to starboard round the northeast end of Dwyrn, and port again round the point of Avra, they entered into a good harbour on Avra's southern shore, where Byrne's pleasant land sloped down to the water's edge. Byrne's people, many of whom they saw working in the fields, were all freemen, and it was a happy and prosperous fief. Here they all went ashore, and were royally feasted in a low, pillared house overlooking the bay. Byrne and his gracious wife and merry daughters made them good cheer. But after dark, Byrne sent a messenger over by boat to Dwyrn to order some preparations—he did not say exactly what—for the following day.